This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Later this hour, former President Jimmy Carter joins us to talk about this American moment, and we'd like to hear from you about what this election, this campaign means to you on a personal level. You can send us email now, talk@npr.org. But first, we Americans hate crime, but sometimes we love a good con. A criminal is one thing, but a con man is an artist. They get our grudging respect even when they're not Paul Newman or Robert Redford, maybe because we have so little sympathy for most of those they take in. A case in point, the con whose story is all over the front pages on the East Coast, a stylish, friendly, ascot-wearing man who called himself Clark Rockefeller. You know, of those Rockefellers. He convinced everybody, including two well-placed wives, posh clubs, an Upper East Side art dealer, and a New York, New Hampshire state senator, that he might just be an American blue blood. It turns out he's German by birth, used a different name in California, where police would like to talk to him about what might be murder, and still another name in Baltimore. These days, most grifters gravitate to the World Wide Web and pose as Nigerian princes, but there are still con artists out there who flim-flam face-to-face. If you've been swindled by a con artist, call and tell us your story. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also comment on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. We begin with Michael Levinson, who's one of the lead reporters on the Clark Rockefeller investigation for the Boston Globe. He joins us from New Hampshire Public Radio. Nice to have you on the program today.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
And how did the story of Clark Rockefeller's many identities leak out?
Well, it began when he allegedly kidnapped his daughter off a Boston street on July 27th. And at that point, it appeared that this man might actually be a Rockefeller. All we knew was that his name was Clark Rockefeller, and he seemed to be perhaps connected to that family. As police began to dig a little bit deeper into his identity, they began to unwind this long tale of, series of aristocratic aliases, and eventually discovered that he is, in fact, this German-born man who had lived at various points all across the United States and is, in fact, wanted for questioning in connection with the 1985 disappearance and presumed slaying of his landlords in California.
Which is a worrisome thought. Nevertheless, throughout his life in this country, he seems to have been able to convince an awful lot of people that he was somebody else.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. When he was living in California, he went by the name Christopher Chichester and told people that he was a European aristocrat with castles back home in Europe and a line of luxury cars that were all at his disposal. Later, he moved to Connecticut in the late 1980s and landed a series of jobs as a bond salesman and was even quoted in some trade publications talking about his market analysis.
Though he apparently knew very little about the business.
Though he did end up losing these jobs, and his colleagues say he really knew little about finance. He was apparently able to talk his way into the job, but once there, he couldn't really hold on to it for very long.
And he had art that he passed off as a genuine masterpieces by Rothko, among others, and managed to get some art dealers pretty convinced that he was who he said he was, too.
That's right. He did have this collection of art, and it's not exactly clear whether those were authentic or not. Friends would recount him, sort of kicking around tubes on the floor of his apartment and just saying, oh, there's a Rothko in there. And, they would assume there was.
Well, how did he parlay this impersonation into, well, a lifestyle?
It's pretty remarkable. For a good period of his life, it seemed like it was hard for him to make money and hard for him to maintain the appearance that he was an aristocrat. When he was living in California, friends said he was often sort of dressed in some threadbare clothing and driving a beat-up car. He was often coming around their apartments hungry at night. So he didn't seem to have the bank account of an aristocrat. Later on in 1995, he ended up marrying a woman who was then a Harvard Business School student, and she became a very successful consultant for McKinsey & Company, and apparently was able to live a bit more to his style.
Mm. And she was the mother of the daughter who he later kidnapped and took to Baltimore.
That's correct. Yeah, the couple divorced in December. Apparently when she began to have doubts about his true identity.
And he took her to Baltimore, where he had apparently prepared yet another identity, his boat. Yeah, he had a boat, but his boat had apparently been there for a couple of years.
That's right. He had bought a condo under yet another alias, this time Chip Smith, and had told friends just before he left Boston that, you know, he might be setting sail on his yacht for, you know, a foreign port. And it turns out he had just had this condo in Baltimore and a very dilapidated catamaran that he had tethered there.
We're talking with Michael Levinson about the remarkable story of Clark Rockefeller. We'd like you to weigh in. Have you ever been swindled by a con man? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Ryan's with us on the line. Ryan calling us from Chicago, Illinois.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Very well, thanks.
Good. This is several years ago now, actually back in 96. I was in college, and a friend of mine introduced me to what I thought at that point was a radio personality. He went by the name of Ron Harper, and said he was Ron Harper from, I believe, WLS, which was the station.
Big radio station there, AM radio station in Chicago, yeah, and around half the country, yeah.
Exactly. And met the gentleman, very charismatic, an older gentleman, and said that, you know, he had some openings, some positions that he would like to put us into. My friend and I were both fairly young at the time and fairly naive, and said that he just needed a certain amount of money to get started. And this was after several conversations. And mm-hmm. We fell for it and actually kind of brought him into our family, so to speak. And my parents actually met the gentleman and fell for it as well. He pretended to interview my brother at a football game and was going to put it on the air. And long story short, he skipped town with a couple grand of our money and, you know, just felt a little stupid afterwards and should have done the research and finding out who this person actually was.
Well, I just wanted to assure you that any real radio personality would never stoop to such a thing.
Of course
not. Ryan, thanks for... In retrospect, the guy must have been a pretty good actor.
Yeah. You know, I have to give him some credit for having the chutzpah to, you know, go after people like this. And he had us going. I mean, he had a lot of contacts, apparently, and really acted like it. So,
well,
it fooled me.
Wiser and a little less rich, so...
Yeah, true.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call, Ryan.
Have a great day.
And Michael Levinson, you've talked to people, and you and others have talked to people who were taken in by this quote-unquote Clark Rockefeller. What do they say about how convincing he was?
Well, some of them said he was very convincing. They described him as sort of charming and erudite and seemed to have enough anecdotes about his background that they believed him. Others said that they suspected something was wrong. I mean, sometimes his tales would wander from the believable into the far-fetched, and they would sense that something was amiss.
Some people had questions. I mean, he lived at one point in a relatively small town in New England, and, David Rockefeller, a real Rockefeller, lived right up the road.
That's right, and apparently people who spoke to him had asked him, you know, are you related to this guy? And he said, no, I'm not. I've never heard of him.
Clark Rockefeller, though, was always somewhat vague, I gather. He said, well, I may well be related to the Rockefellers.
That's right. He seemed to sort of like to play with the notion and not disabuse people of it. You know, people would ask him and he would sort of dance around it and say, I think I might be.
Did he actually put the touch on people for money? Did he get thousands or hundreds of thousands out of this?
You know, that's interesting. I don't think he did. As far as I know, he wasn't engaging in this con for any type of monetary gain. It just seemed to be something that he did because he wanted to, and there wasn't any financial setup involved.
Except for whatever benefit he got out of his marriage.
Certainly, yeah. Exactly. When he did marry her, you know, he did obviously was able to come into some more money, and then apparently through the divorce landed a sizable settlement as well.
And in prison, continues to insist that he's Clark Rockefeller.
That's right. Along with two other reporters from the Globe, I got to interview him in the jail in Boston where he's being held. And, you know, he striking. The first thing he does is walk into the room, stick out his hand to greet us and say, "I'm Clark Rockefeller. Clark Rockefeller, it's good to meet you. I'm Clark Rockefeller." And, you know, he knows full well that at this point we've heard from the FBI and other authorities that he's actually a German man named Christian Karl Gerhardsreiter. So he's still, you know, clinging to this identity, even though the authorities say it's just a fiction.
Let's get another caller on the line. And Mike is with us. Mike on the line from Cleveland, Ohio.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm well, thanks.
Yeah, my mother-in-law is a con artist. In fact, we're searching for her now. She's gotten in trouble from stealing from a number of large corporations, one of them being the largest retail in the world, and then going ahead and performing, doing check fraud on a number of people. Recently disappeared and can't find her and can't find any trace of her as far as what she claimed her maiden name was.
And the largest retailer in the world, that begins with a W, is that right?
Yes, that's just one of them. She got, I guess, quite a bit of money out of them.
And are among those...
A handful others.
Among those she has conned, would that include her family?
Yes. She one of the check scams that she had done included an account that my wife was a co-signer on that, you know, she had forgotten about for years and years and years. And it just crept on us, crept up on us about 2 or 3 months ago, actually.
And this, you know, it's one thing to be fooled by somebody you meet fairly casually, and boy, you feel like an idiot. A member of your family?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We had some sort of idea that something wasn't quite right, and we didn't know quite what it was until, you know, we received a couple calls from a bank, you know, telling us that we owe them a substantial amount of money for, you know, said check.
Well, Mike, I hope this works out. Maybe it's...
Oh, definitely. I'm not sweating over it now. I just don't have to deal with her anymore. It kind of worked out.
All right. Well, thanks very much for the call. Good luck to you.
Okay, well, raggle fraggle.
Mike Levinson, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Michael Levinson, one of the lead reporters on the Clark Rockefeller case for the Boston Globe. He joined us today from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio. When we come back, we're going to continue talking about the art of the con. We'll find out why people are so likely to fall for an honest face and a good opening line. Have you ever been conned? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Former President Jimmy Carter will join us a bit later in the program as part of our series of conversations about this American moment. Tell us what this moment, this election, this campaign means to you. You can email us now. Our address is talk@npr.org. And right now we're continuing our conversation about the art of the con. Most schemes aren't as elaborate as the Clark Rockefeller case, but one thing every con has in common is a mark. We'll talk more about why we tend to fall for a good con in just a moment. If you've been swindled by a con artist, tell us your story. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. The con artist may be good, but she or he needs to have a willing mark to make it work. Jane Risen is an assistant professor of behavioral science at the University of Chicago, and she joins us to tell us more about why we might trust a grifter. She's with us from the studios on the university campus there in Chicago. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
So why would somebody trust someone like Clark Rockefeller with such an implausible story?
Well, I think that, you know, as it was described before, he would have anecdotes that should, you know, that would make it sound plausible. And it's not, there's nothing about a particular individual that necessarily makes them more susceptible to being a victim. We find that it tends to be across the board. They're using very common basic tactics of social influence, and it tends to work because in most day-to-day life, you're not interacting with a con artist. And so when people offer you something and they want something in return, reciprocity is one of the, you know, the hallmarks of the way we interact. And so when someone uses that particular tactic to their advantage, you can end up being fooled when you might not otherwise.
So we're programmed to trust people?
Not necessarily programmed. I mean, it's just that these are the basic tools that we use when we interact with people in general. So reciprocity is very important. Or social consensus. If you learn that other people are going along with something, that's a cue for you to think that this is real. And there's nothing wrong with that process. It just can be exploited by certain individuals. And so it's not that you're programmed to trust. In fact, if you ask people, they're probably, when they think about the population in general, if anything, they report sort of high levels of skepticism and almost expecting that people are always out for their self-interest. But then when it gets to that individual person that you're interacting with, sometimes that can fall away.
So if you meet somebody on the street and they establish some rapport of some sort and they say, gee, I don't know, maybe you can help me out with a problem. I just found $10,000. I don't know what to do with it. You're inclined to go along with what turns out to be a scheme called the pigeon drop.
Yeah, exactly. So once you have that contact, and sometimes it might be that the fraud itself doesn't happen until several contacts. So it may seem like this is just a regular relationship, and then something happens later on once they've gained some of your trust. And it can be when you meet them on the street, or also when you get the email, which is probably the more common tactic used these days.
These days, yeah, it's the Nigerian prince who needs help to thaw out the bank account, and if you could just send him a few $1,000s, well. Millions will come your way.
Exactly. All of these different tactics which promise you, you're already a winner. We just don't know which prize it is. You just have to pay for the shipping or something along those lines. Or this is a charity that we're collecting donations for, basically taking people's good intentions or their own self-interest and manipulating that.
Their own self-interest, not to put too fine a point on it, their greed.
It can be. There's certain investment schemes that if they're too good to be true, you probably should think that they are too good to be true. But sometimes it might be, something more like just, you won a prize. It's a television or it's a toaster oven or something small. And you wouldn't think that someone was greedy because they would be pleased with having won some sort of small prize. And yet that sort of the attraction to those sorts of prizes can get people in trouble, as with charity. So it's not only their own self-interest.
And is part of our interest in these kinds of crimes, the idea that somebody like a Clark Rockefeller could put something over on the swells in New York and Boston, well, that makes us feel better because they look like idiots.
Yeah, there's a funny thing about this being a crime is that to really understand it, we have to understand it as a crime and understand that it's not the victims. There's nothing special about those victims. It tends to be that this is just who they happen to have targeted. And if you can think about it that way and realize, especially for yourself, we're getting these calls describing mm-hmm. incidents when they've experienced it. It can happen to anybody, very well educated, young, old, middle-aged, and to realize that they're being taken and it is a crime and we have to pay attention to how it happens.
Yes. Let's see if we get another one of those callers on the line. Let's go to Chris, and Chris joins us from Hot Spring in Arkansas.
Good afternoon. I'm a former police officer, and I just wanted to relate a story of a case that we had. A sales manager from a car dealership in a neighboring town called me when I was a detective, stating that he had someone trying to buy a car over the phone, and it didn't really make sense to him. Supposedly, it was an elderly gentleman who did not read or write, was wanting to set up to purchase this car and have it delivered. But it sounded a little fishy when he told him that we would need to deliver the car to his nephew, who had a power of attorney for him. And there were several phone calls exchanged, and we basically got into where I was posing as the manager of the dealership, and we set up the drop, and the gentleman actually ended up being arrested prior to being able to set it up. A couple months later, we found out that he was in federal prison and had obtained student loans in five other different names while he was behind bars.
Wow. But as it turned out, you stung the sting.
Pretty much. the gentleman who was the victim whose name was being used was completely unaware, and he was, in fact, an elderly gentleman who did not read or write but had no knowledge of this other person. Apparently, he had gotten some mail of his, knew him, from the neighborhood, knew that he was elderly, and just took advantage of the situation.
Somebody who was relatively gullible or easily convinced that to join in on the scheme, unwittingly.
Correct.
Was that the only case of a con game that you've had in your career as a police officer?
Oh, there's been several with forgeries and hot checks of those natures, but those are usually pretty small time. That was one that stood out just from the dollar amount and the sheer complexity of it, having to arrange the deal.
Chris, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Jane Risen, as you listen to that story, clearly the victim not in it for greed, just somebody who was, a little confused maybe.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes it's funny when he mentioned the car one. It reminds me of recently looking on Craigslist for a car. And the first time you come across one of these scams, it's something like, you know, I'm a widow. My husband recently passed away. I don't drive stick shift, and I need to deal with this. And your first reaction is, oh, I feel terrible. Maybe this will mean I'll get a good deal, but I feel bad for her. And then you come across three or four or five of these, and then you start to realize that it's a con. But the first time you see one, it's just a personal story, and it depends on how complex and strange it gets. But sometimes it doesn't kind of trigger your suspicion radar until you start seeing it often enough.
Yeah, the first time I got one of those eBay messages, I don't have an account at eBay, but I was going to provide the information, and then, whoa.
Yeah, and the most important thing then is to educate people about how these are being done, and to almost, sometimes it's worth even coming up with strategies with how to deal with it, whether it's not picking up these phone calls, deleting the emails immediately, but sometimes having sort of a plan for how to deal with it is important, because they range from being very very easy to catch, and they're just kind of hoping that if they send it out broad enough, someone will fall for it, to being quite complex, like mimicking what your computer server help desk actually, what their email actually, you know, what their emails actually look like, and sending it to you in that format. And so it can be a range in how complex they are and how likely it is that you're going to run into trouble with it.
Let's get Jesse on the line. Jesse with us from Grand Junction in Colorado.
Hi, I would just like to relate the story of my father who was swindled by a woman. He became romantically involved with her several years ago, and it turned out she was using somewhat of a fake alias, ended up stealing, close to $100,000 from him and his business. The funny part was she kept getting thrown in jail. And because she had a warrant out for her arrest related to a prior conviction for fraud at another company. And each time he would go to the jail, I think it was three times, to bail her out, she would say, oh, there's this big misunderstanding. There's this other woman out there with a similar name, and she keeps getting in trouble. And they keep, you know, every time I get stopped for a speeding ticket, they throw me into jail. And it was just very sad because he got taken in by the whole thing. And, you know, it was a big hit to his self-confidence.
And if there was romance involved, I mean, the money may have been the least of it.
Exactly. Yeah, he was divorced for several years and was, you know, eagerly awaiting the end of his bachelordom, I think. And you know, it started to sound fishy to me after the second time she got thrown into jail and supposedly the police had mistaken her identity. So
yeah.
It was very difficult for him.
Did he recover his confidence?
He did. He's very resilient, yes, and currently she's being prosecuted for a couple of felonies related to it.
Well, Jesse, let's hope all that works out, too.
Yes, thank you.
All right, appreciate the phone call. And Jane Risen, I guess when romance and its associated passions are involved, our judgment is even more clouded than usual.
Absolutely. As soon as there's a personal connection, it becomes a lot harder to recognize it. If the same thing happened to someone else and you heard the same story, you might be suspicious. But once you're wrapped up in it, you're not as likely to be, because most people tend to think of themselves as very smart, capable, you know, good people. And so that kind of comes into conflict with the idea that they're being swindled. And so it's hard to recognize it even once it started to take place. Both it's hard to admit to yourself and to others because it seems like it's in conflict. You have to remember that there's nothing about you that's creating this. And it's important to sort of keep your eyes and ears open and listen to other people. If you have close family and friends telling you that something's suspicious, to be open to that.
Once we start to trust somebody, is it difficult to start to be skeptical?
I think so. Once you start to trust them, you change your interaction. You change, you know, what you're paying attention to. It almost sort of constrains what set of beliefs you can create. And so once you're in that relationship, you just treat them differently. And of course, you know, an important thing to always remember that is that it's important to be able to trust, right? So you don't want to be skeptical of everybody. There's a reason we're more skeptical of strangers and less skeptical of the people that we get to know better, because it's important to be able to have that level of trust and intimacy if you're going to have relationships with people. And there's some good work that suggests that the tendency to trust is very much related to the tendency to be trustworthy. And so it's, you know, it's kind of a double-edged sword to be the kind of person who is trustworthy may make it harder for you to recognize that other people aren't going to have that same nature.
Well, it's kind of how civilization works. I mean, other than the immediate members of our hunter-gatherer group, it must have taken some work so that you could start to trust people from outside your group.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So you sort of expand your social network and you slowly, you know, let down some of your guards. And that works most of the time.
Expand your definition of us, if you will.
Absolutely.
Jane Risen, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Jane Risen is Assistant Professor of Behavioral Science at the University of Chicago, with us from a studio on the campus there in Chicago. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Julian on the line. Julian with us from Hampton in Virginia.
Hi. I had a situation where when I was very young, my first wife and I were going to get married. And in the process of that, we met our best man and her best friend. And they brought us into a pyramid scheme. And it was very sad because basically everything that you've been saying occurred. We trusted them. They were people that were close to us in terms of you know, they were the sister of our best friend.
And they were unwitting, or were they? Did they know this?
You know, it's hard to tell because at the time, the scheme was to sell cosmetics. It was called COSCOT, Cosmetics for the Communities of Tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
It was really incredible. And this took place in New York. You'd think there would be sophisticated people in New York that would see all this. I'm talking about the city of New York. And, apparently ourselves and not just a few, but the thousands of people fell for it. It was as obvious as it could be once you step back and look at it. But in the meantime, they were supposedly selling cosmetics. There were ownerships that were brought in at different levels. If you got a $5,000 ownership or a $2,500 ownership, that would mean you got a certain level. You could bring in other people at the same level, blah, blah, blah.
And
it was horrible.
Well, these are all just variations of the scheme. Most famously associated with Charles Ponzi in New England all those years ago.
Yes, yes, yes. And what made it sad was that, you know, after you looked at it and looked at your part in it, because we eventually did become involved in it, you became very sad and embarrassed about yourself. And, you know, of course, you want to forget it as quickly as possible. Nonetheless, I mean, the memory of that, of his artistry and his... He wasn't even that much of a charismatic person. Actually, he was a harelip, and he would get up in front of people and make these pronouncements with the worst possible expressions and speech. Because people were greedy enough to want to get in on it and make a fast buck, and they did, and didn't examine it closely enough to say, "Wait a minute, this is wrong. This is who's selling the product?
Where is the product?
Is the product? Where is it actually being retailed to a real public? And you know, where's the profit? Well, the profit is all in how many people you can bring in under the same level, and how many cuts you get of their level, and how many people into them they bring in, et cetera, et cetera." And it's a memory that I'm very hard to remember, but good to forget.
Julian, thanks for recalling it for us.
Sure.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can get another call in. This is Terry. Terry with us from Fresno in California.
Hi, Neil. Love your show.
Thank you.
I got taken in when I worked at a restaurant in Kansas. I was working an evening shift, and some people came in. An older gentleman came in. He was looking very poor, and he said he couldn't afford the meal unless he went to the bank, but he would leave his violin as collateral, and I said, okay. And another well-dressed gentleman came in, or was sitting at the restaurant, too, and said, you know, I'll buy that from you right now.
That's a Stradivarius, yeah.
Yes, it's a very, it could be worth $10,017. And I was young, I didn't know what I was doing, so I immediately took his card and went through all the money in the cash register until I got, you know, enough money to buy it from the man when he came back. And when I went to call up the gentleman to sell it to him for, I'd bought the violin from the older gentleman for $700. I had to really convince him to sell it, too.
Yeah.
And when I finally went to get it appraised, I found out it was worth about $5. So I felt pretty foolish, lost my job. I figured I could pay back the owner of the restaurant with the money I made from the violin, and he'd be happy. But nope, it was a good learning experience, and I still have the violin. But it was definitely my own greed that got me drawn into it. I could have just as easily said no, but it sounds like you've heard this con before.
It's not unfamiliar, but as it turns out, it was probably a useful tip.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for your show. I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay, Terry. Thanks very much for the call. We just want to end with this email that we got from, I'm not sure who we got it from. My first year of undergrad, all the students on the campus wall sat on the campus wall to meet each other. I met a gentleman who said he was a second-year medical student. Of course, I thought I'd hit pay dirt, called my mom and told her I'd met a med student, only to find out he was a local scam artist. It was a good lesson in my own superficiality. And I guess the lesson to learn is, be careful. Trust, but verify. I can't remember who said that. Coming up, we're going to talk about This American Moment with former President Jimmy Carter, who will join us from Denver. If you'd like to join the conversation, tell us what this campaign, this election means to you. 800-989-8255. Send us an email, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.